Support for NPR podcasts comes from A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In the neoconservative camp that pushed for war with Iraq, Norman Podhoretz is a great patriarch, one of the old originals. But he's hardly out to pasture. He's a senior advisor to Rudy Giuliani. He counsels George Bush in the White House. And here's what he's saying. We are in the midst of World War IV, a life and death super struggle with Islamofascism. We should bomb Iran. And anyone who doesn't agree is a threat to the nation. Hawks love him. Critics say he's hysterical and dangerous. He's still pushing. Up next on Point, Norman Podhoretz and the debate over his World War IV. Joining me now from New York is one-time leftist turned neoconservative Norman Podhoretz. He is editor-at-large for Commentary Magazine. He's a senior foreign policy advisor to presidential candidate Rudy Giuliani. His new book is called World War IV, The Long Struggle Against Islamofascism. The Weekly Standard calls it instructive and important. Rush Limbaugh calls it bold and brilliant. Ian Baruma, writing the New York Review of Books, calls its arguments zany, unhinged, and a dangerous form of hysteria. One note, Mr. Podhoretz would only appear on our program without other guests on at the same time. So later in this hour, after he's said his piece, we'll hear from two critics of the Podhoretz view, retired Army general and former head of the NSA, William Odom, and from a reporter in the field, longtime Mideast correspondent Christopher Dickey of Newsweek. But first, with us from New York, Norman Podhoretz, welcome back to the show. Good to have you.
Thanks, Tom.
So let's see. How's the war going in the field and at home, if it's World War IV?
The war in the field is going reasonably well, considering that it's in the early years. I mean, we are about where we were in World War III, which was the Cold War, and I think in retrospect can be seen more precisely as World War III. We're about where we were in 1952 in World War III, and As you may recall, if you're old enough, that was a point at which we had lost well over 30,000 men in Korea, and President Harry Truman's approval ratings were 10 points lower than President Bush's are now. He didn't dare run for re-election. He was considered by most people one of the worst presidents we'd ever had. Of course, in retrospect, almost everyone now agrees that he was a great president.
I am not old enough to remember, in fact, but it was not an easy point in that confrontation with the Soviet Union. So reasonably well in the field, you say, and we'll look at that. What about at home?
Well, again, I think many parallels to the Cold War, World War III, exist both in the field and at home. There was a very strong anti-war movement that developed after the enunciation of the Truman Doctrine in 1947, which basically was the declaration of war against Soviet expansionism. And Truman was both opposed furiously and ridiculed from the left, the right, and even the center. The doctrine was very, very controversial. Many people poo-pooed the Soviet threat. They said that it was wildly exaggerated by Truman, that he was being hysterical. They said that there was more danger from Truman than from Stalin. They said that the only possible way to move was through making a deal, diplomacy. Stalin wanted peace, and it was the United States that wanted war. Group of critics coalesced eventually into an anti-war movement that reached its height of power and influence during Vietnam. And I think that the anti-war movement we have here in this country today has been working off the anti-war movement's playbook during the Vietnam period and has been achieving great successes, at least in influencing public opinion.
Let's come very much up to date, if we can, Neumann Podhoretz. The war's going reasonably well in the field. The World War IV you describe, you say. How does Iraq factor into that? That hardly seems to be the impression of most Americans, even some of those who, like you, pushed for that war. Max Boot has come on this show and said, oh, boy, you know, we're in a deep, deep bad hole there. Richard Pearl has spoken remorsefully about what's happened there. How do you see that as going reasonably well?
Well, I see Iraq as the second front to have been opened in World War IV, the first one, of course, being Afghanistan, and the likely next front is Iran. When you ask how things are going in Iraq, my question always is, compared to what? The notion that there have been calamitous mistakes made in the execution of the policy. Yeah, but I think that these mistakes, even if some of them are not even mistakes, judgment calls that might have gone worse if they'd been made the other way. But in any event, even if you stipulate that every one of the alleged mistakes actually was a mistake, I consider them what I call in my book, World War IV, chump change compared to the mistakes that were made in World War II, a war that was run by great men like Roosevelt and Churchill, where hundreds of thousands of lives were squandered by military decisions that were ill-advised, by incompetent execution of strategy, and also by simple inter-alliance politics, like the invasion of Italy, where more Americans died on the first day of the beaches of Anzio, I think, that have died since 9/11.
You know, I had an uncle in that invasion, but I want to try and keep it in the here and now. It's so urgent, and you're putting a big marquee World War IV on it.
Sure.
Islamofascism is what you say it's against. That word had a kind of moment in the sun, what was it, 18 months ago now, maybe back when you were writing this book. We hear very little about it now. Do all the players in this great big war board that you describe here fit under that label? What do you mean by Islamofascism?
Well, as the reason I like that word is that it encapsulates what I call in my book the two-headed monster against which declared war on us long before 9/11, but it took 9/11 to make us realize that and to begin fighting back. It's I call it a two-headed monster because one head is mainly religious, the other head is mainly secular. The Taliban represented the religious head most saliently, and we went after it in Afghanistan and defeated it, and set
for a time. Now they're talking about bringing it into the government there.
Well, I can get into that if you like. I mean, but
I take your point. I didn't mean to interrupt.
Yeah, and in any event, we did overthrow the Taliban regime and help to put in place the first democratically elected government in the history of that country. We then took on the main secular embodiment of the Islamo-fascist two-headed monster, represented by Saddam Hussein. And the purpose here, as enunciated in the Bush Doctrine, was to reshape the political configuration of the region. I like to summarize it as making the Middle East safe for America by making it safe for democracy. And to execute that strategy involved having to, what the president used to call, drain the swamps in which Islamofascism bred and out of which its main instrument of war, namely terrorism, was nourished, supported by various states, and which had grown to be so great a danger to us that it succeeded in pulling off what neither Hitler nor Stalin ever succeeded in doing, namely hitting us where we live on our own soil. And this has to be borne in mind when people poo-poo the power of the Islamo-fascist enemy.
And where do you see this World War IV going, if that's what it is, if it is against some kind of unified Islamo-fascist force, as you describe it? I mean, there's a very kind of Armageddon tone about the book. Is this a knockdown, drag-out, life or death, the West against the East, the West against a billion Muslims? Where does this go?
Well, I don't think it is a billion Muslims. Islamofascism is not the same thing as Islam. That's why a special term had to be coined for it. It's a political movement that developed within Islam, not in the 7th century when Islam was born, but in the 20th century when certain strands within Islam took political lessons first from the Nazis, who moved into the area during World War II. By the way, we have this on the testimony of the Islamofascists themselves.
But we already have troops in Iraq and Afghanistan. You're saying bomb Iran. Mm-hmm. Many are saying that might take us also into Pakistan. I mean, pretty soon you're in a lot of the Islamic world.
Well, yeah, but the question is what we're doing there, what we're trying to accomplish there. I think what we're trying to accomplish in World War IV is exactly what we were trying to accomplish in World War III, which mainly was to loosen the grip of a tyrannical totalitarian ideology on a major region of the world. In World War III, it was communism, the Soviet Empire. In this case, it's the Middle East and the Islamofascist regimes that prevail in every country of the region except Israel.
Mr. Budhortz, let me take a call from Burlington, Iowa. Eric, you're on the air.
Tom, thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I have to disagree with the gentleman. Absolutely disagree. Saddam Hussein was a secular thug, and his job was to keep these Islamofascists under control. When we took him out, we gave the actual Islamofascists in Iran the opportunity to do what they've been trying to do for 10 years of fighting Saddam, which was to take over southern and eastern Iraq. This guy is trying to defend the war. The war took out the kind of guy we needed to keep these nuts under control. When Tito was out in Yugoslavia, look what happened. It's the same thing in the Middle East right now because of the war.
Eric, thanks for that. No one but Hortz. We don't have forever, so let's go straight to that. Now it's called the central battlefield globally by President Bush in the war on terror. When Saddam Hussein ran it, it wasn't pretty, but it wasn't the central battlefield either.
Well, I think it was one of the central battlefields in that Saddam Hussein was not merely a thug keeping Iran from dominating the region. He was himself a threat within the region and a threat to us, in my opinion. And I'm not even talking about the weapons of mass destruction issue. If you're going to fight back against the forces that attacked us on 9/11, incidentally, I do not say we should be plunged into World War IV. I think we were.
So we're
plunged
in it. Mm-hmm.
We're in it, and we were pushed in it on 9/11. The long range strategy that was adopted by the Bush doctrine and ratified incidentally by most Americans at the time, and including most members of Congress and even most Democrats, was that in the long run, we had to change the political configuration of that region. It was not enough to take out the Taliban. We had to drain the swamps in which Islamofascist terrorism grew. And we had to do that by replacing those regimes which had been giving aid and comfort to terrorists, which included Saddam Hussein. And the way to do that, sometimes it would be necessary to do it by military means. In other cases, diplomacy, sanctions, whatever, non-military means would be employed, if possible, and only military means only as a last resort.
But it's big military.
Which is
right
incidentally
now
what happened with Saddam Hussein.
Let me take some more calls, if I may. I know our time with you is short. Many people want to speak with you. Rob in Plainfield, Connecticut. Rob, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. You know, I hear this term Islamofascism. This is a new one. Anti-Semitism was the one before. But, I mean, I think we need to start talking about the Judeo-fascism of Norman Podhoretz and the fact that history is going to say that America was driven to commit a Holocaust in the Middle East at the behest of the Jewish lobby. And, you know, Mr. Podhoretz is an example of that.
Norman Podhoretz,
yeah, well,
what do you say to that?
I'm not going to argue with the blatant anti-Semitism of that question.
But you do raise it in your book. You go to this and say, let's look at it.
Let's look at what?
At the characterization that has been out there along the lines that Rob is just raising. I mean, you do pick it up in the book. What do you say to
that? I go through a very careful analysis.
Yes, you do.
Of Islamofascism. I'm not throwing around names or epithets. Very careful analysis based on statements that were made by the people involved. I go through a very careful analysis of the what I call the domestic insurgency and its various components.
You mean an American insurgency,
yeah.
which you call guerrillas with tenure. That sounds like an epithet, but is it not?
Guerrillas with tenure was a phrase invented by the socialist Irving Howe, late Irving Howe, talking about the people who took over the universities who had come up from the New Left in the late 60s. In any event, what you can argue with my analyses all you like, but I simply won't engage in the kind of abusive, vitriolic, anti-Semitic abuse that this caller has hurled at me.
Let's look at the domestic front, then. You are very, very tough on those who disagree with you. I mean, you call them, I mean, you raise this guerrillas with tenure phrasing, domestic insurgents, you call it. You say we're in the midst of a civil war here, almost as bloody as that in Iraq. That's quite a large comparison. Yeah. So what does all that mean? Do we, in your view, need a new McCarthy era to kind of get in there and weed out the appeasers?
Well, the McCarthyism these days is on the other foot. I mean, it's people like me who are being McCarthyized. But leaving that aside, what I call the domestic insurgency is made up of several different groups who are violently against this war. And I don't just mean Iraq. I mean the whole idea of World War IV, of a new world war, and who have, for various reasons, depending on where they stand, an investment in the failure of the Bush Doctrine, and they make no bones about it. I don't even have to go beyond quoting them.
You're saying don't truly believe it's wrong. They just want it to fail for their own personal gain.
Well, of course they feel it's wrong, and it's not a question of gain. I mean, but if you have a certain view of the world that is being challenged, in fact repudiated by the president. And you think your view of the world is right, and you're heavily invested in it, you will naturally, repudiate the challenge and hope that it fails because you think it's. Of course, you think it's wrong, but you also know that it makes your own ideas seem obsolete.
Let's go to Thillet, calling from Boston.
That's true of several of the groups that, I analyze very carefully and quote from the liberal internationalists, the isolationists, both on the left and the right, and many of the realists and many members of the mainstream media.
And you hang some very big and damning labels on them in that analysis. Let's go to Thillet, calling from Boston.
I hang no labels.
Guerrillas with tenure
don't come out of their own writings. Guerrillas with tenure, as I say, was not even my phrase. It's a phrase that comes out of the 60s.
Domestic insurgents, as in. Well, it's a big label. That's what I'm pointing to.
It's an insurgency mounted against the war we're in. Yes,
or it's American citizens who are critics of the war. I'm just saying it's two ways of describing it. One has a little more heat on it, doesn't it?
Why not? I mean,
hey,
sure.
Okay. Okay. Thillet's calling from Boston. Thillet, you're on the air.
Yes, sir. I want to say thank you to the gentleman who wrote that book. Actually, we need a clear understanding of who our enemy is. And if we want to be successful in this war, we need to define, to understand our enemy. The problem of Americans, I am American too, but most Americans, they don't want to face the reality, and or maybe they are scared to name Islam. But it is a fact. We are in the war with these people, and we cannot deny the fact. And if we want to win this war, we need to understand our enemy very clear.
Thillet, we've got it, and your thumbs up for Norman Podhoretz there. Mr. Podhoretz, I've just got you for a minute. Let me ask you about two.
Glad to get some support.
You've got it right there. Let me ask you about two Americans in particular. You sat down not long ago with George Bush. Is he on the same page as you? And what about Rudy Giuliani, who you're advising and are in, I understand, in regular phone conferences with his crew? Is he on the same page as you?
Well, I think that he certainly agrees that we're in a world war and that we have to win it. I don't know that he agrees with every detail of my own analysis. I offer him advice, which he's free to take or reject. And I don't speak for him, and I don't dictate his policies. But my view is that his idea of the war is quite close to mine. And obviously so is George Bush's. I might say that my view of the war is close to his. He sees it as the succession to the last two totalitarian threats that came at us in World War II and World War III.
Do you see progress on the ground? When was the last time you were in these Middle Eastern countries and others that you're describing?
I haven't been in Iraq and Afghanistan at all. What I know is
Iran or no, Pakistan.
Never been in that region. What I know is what I read, and I read a lot. Try to follow what's happening. When I say it's going reasonably well on the ground, what I mean is that two totalitarian regimes have been toppled. The seeds of democratization have been planted both in Afghanistan and Iraq, which I believe will mature and grow and blossom. And as for Iran, it's another story. I mean, practically everyone in the world believes that it would be calamitous for Iran to develop a nuclear weapon. The argument is how to stop it. And what I did in my article and in my book is to, again, carefully analyze the various alternatives and try to show that nothing will work except